On this episode of Movies Ruined My Life, we're drinking wine and counting down our favorite Woody Allen flicks. So this is Paula.
Hello.
And I'm Brandon. Danny is supposed to be here, but we're hoping he shows up sometime soon. We're hoping he's all right and on his way. Devin is off screen, but probably not going to participate all that much. And Woody Allen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Paul, you really were adamant that we had to do a panel for Woody off the jump. I was a little apprehensive about it. I'm really happy now, though, that I got to revisit some of his film catalog, some of the stuff that I absolutely adore of his. And we're going to have a little fun with it in the next few segments. But we talked a little off air about why you relate to this cat so much, and I'm curious.
Why? Well, I've always thought if there was a director that was going to direct my life story or at least write it, I'd want Woody Allen to do it. I've just always found myself relating to a lot of his characters. I'm not going to say exactly which characters, but yeah, I see the way my brain works in a lot of his movies, and they're so fun to watch.
Right on. For me, he's a guy that he uses his movies as an outlet for some of his interior monologues, you know, some of his neuroses mm-hmm. comes out on the screen, and this microphone is bothering me. And and one thing that I absolutely adore is that he, much in the same way as guys that we've already kind of talked about, like Sam Raimi, like the Coens to some extent, he very much uses film in this experimental form where he himself is in the audience with you almost. Mm-hmm. He's part of the audience. He's sharing in everything with you. So he'll break the fourth wall. He'll maybe take a juxtaposition to an opinion that he has just to get you thinking. It's really interesting. I very much enjoy the moments with Woody, and why mm-hmm. I'm a fan of a lot of his older catalog, particularly the Keaton and Mia Farrow years. I know that you've mentioned a lot of the newer stuff mm-hmm. falls higher on your, you know, on your list of favorites. But for me, I think there's something about him being on screen and literally being the ones delivering these lines. It's there's no disconnect between the typewriter, his old rickety old typewriter, mm-hmm. and
that
you.
He still writes on.
Yeah, that he still writes on. Very cool.
Yeah.
I don't know. So what we're going to do with this episode, well, we're going to have a little fun in the last segment and basically nominate our choice film to be saved in the event that all other Woody Allen films were to be destroyed. So let's say, just for example, you know, something like in Footloose happens and they're just burning books, in this case, burning films, and they're going to burn every Woody Allen film, but for some reason they permit you to keep one for rewatching. Which one is it? And we're gonna argue that out, and it's interesting because we didn't have to fight over our selections. We both legitimately have different picks,
yeah,
which is
cool.
Yeah,
they're very different.
Yeah. So before we get to that, though, and I'm not a big fan of rankings, but I do like the idea of a top 10 for this guy. We're going to go through our top 10 Woody Allen films, talk about why we like them, and so forth, which you're going to kick us off in a second. But I just, before we get into that, I just want to talk about this Woody Allen as the person, or at least the persona that we know. Obviously, I want to kind of steer clear of all the taboo stuff, to be honest. What goes on behind closed doors, I don't want to get into. This is a movie show. Mm-hmm. We talk about movies. We don't talk about other stuff mm-hmm. here. That being said, obviously, everyone knows that he plays the clarinet, and that's fucking weird. No.
What?
No, I'm kidding. You didn't see that coming.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, like everyone knows about the situation, both with his current wife, formerly Mia Farrow's adopted daughter, the situation that went on in the 90s and has kind of been, has come up more recently again now with what Dylan, his other daughter.
Yeah.
Or with Mia again, adopted daughter. And also most recently, I think Ronan possibly being the child of Frank Sinatra instead of him.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty
so
nice.
It's interesting how much of his life he has played out in the public, and yet somehow the lore of Woody, or at least his persona on screen, is somehow carried through. And it is so interesting to go from Alan Konigsberg to the Woody Allen that we know today, and you know, typing on that old typewriter and sending jokes in the newspapers, and then stand up, which I've heard he hated.
He hated doing it.
Yeah.
He was terrified. Apparently he suffered. He like threw up beforehand. He just looks back now still apparently and still remembers how stressed out he was, but he was great.
Yeah.
And,
oh, totally.
Yeah, he just pulled it off. And yeah, apparently there were shows. I was watching the documentary about him where they talk about how there were shows where he would pretend to hang himself with his microphone cord.
And people thought he would actually do it.
Because he just looks so uncomfortable. But he's so funny that it kind of played through, right?
Yeah. And now that you mention it, I have seen that. And seeing his managers and later on his producers talk about how some nights he would go up and he'd just bomb. Which is the way of any comedian's life, any band, like for us or anyone that you have your bad days. But it is so interesting that they also said there was those moments that is Woody. That's the Woody Allen that we know today. And that's really interesting. I don't know. Do you want to get rolling? You want to get into this list?
Yeah, let's get into the list.
Because this might take a little bit.
I know, it's quite a big list. I mean, we went from, originally you said we were going to do top three, and then we kind of talked about top five, and then went for 10, and then, you know, you have to save one from being burned. And
yeah.
It was a really difficult, painful choosing process. But I think we got a good list.
Okay, so you're going to go first, then we'll take a little break, come back, and I'll divvy out my list, which will probably be fairly different. I don't know. So what do you have at number 10?
Okay, so at number 10, I have Melinda and Melinda.
Oh, really?
Yeah, not because, I mean, there's so many movies and it's still within the top 10, but not so much because of the actual movie or the content of the movie, not that it wasn't good. It was a typical Woody Allen character. I just love the way that it was done as a split.
Yeah.
And it told two stories at once. And that was really fun to watch. And I thought that was really interesting. It basically took some of the same characters he always uses in his newer movies and presented them in a different way. So I think that deserves to be at least top 10.
Right on.
Your what top 10?
Oh, are we going to go in tandem, or do you want to just, let's roll through your entire list.
Oh God.
Because what if we double up?
I don't think that's going to happen.
No? Okay, no, so let's do it.
From some of the conversations we just had, I don't think that's going to happen.
All right, then let's, I'll go next then.
Okay.
My number 10 is Zelig.
Why?
Is that on your list at all?
No, it's not on my list at all.
I love this film. I think that I like the mockumentary format, and there's something special about the way that Woody does it. He obviously plays the main character, Leonard Zelig, and he basically is the he adapts to be whatever everyone else around him is. So, you know, there's that scene with him and the psychiatrist, and he turns into the psychiatrist along with him, and, you know, what if I tell you you're not a psychiatrist? Why would you do that? And with the African-American guys, he changes. With the fat guys, he changes, all the stuff. I love the social commentary of that. And I love that it's in this mockumentary format, because we all do that. We all kind of adapt to social situations. And this is a physical manifestation of it, I realize. But it's more important to me what the undertone of it is. And this one comes to the end or near the end of kind of my favorite era of his, probably. Yeah, and it's a good one. It actually has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, by the way.
Does it?
Zelig, yeah. Pretty solid film. Yeah, I don't know. Number 10. Number 10 for me.
Number 10.
What do you have at 9?
Okay, so for number 9, I have Small Time Crooks. But
oh.
Yeah.
And that's a newer one, right?
Yeah. You know my trend.
Yeah. Now I wanted to ask you, by the way, cuz okay, so around this film, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken, this is where around the period around 2000 where he switched from editing or rather switched to editing digitally. Okay. And I also noticed right around this time through to today for the most part a very big change in his coloring in films.
Yeah.
Very considerably more reds, a lot warmer.
Yeah, a lot warmer.
Yeah. And I wondered what your take on that as a photographer is, because it's so interesting that you look at, obviously, the early stages of his career, very much black and white, and when he did do color stuff, very stark, cold, lots of blues, lots of greens, and then this shift happened around 2000 that just... and even I've heard interviews with him where he talks about, I like warm colors.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what happened to make that shift, because it is a very obvious visual change. Like when you watch an older movie from, say, pre-2000 to something mm-hmm. in the current era of Woody Allen, you really do notice
They're
that difference.
Cold, as opposed to the newer movies that are very warm and like they have like a golden sunlight feel. Everything's like magic hour. You know, everything's got that feel to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it probably just has to do with him getting more into the digital editing and mm-hmm. just being able to make things look the way he wanted.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. You could have always done just like filters, right?
Yeah, yeah. I don't believe that it was to do with the technology, though. I really don't, because say for example, like a lot of it is lighting, and a lot of it because you still have to be able to extract those colors, obviously, sure. right?
Mm-hmm.
And I maybe it just wasn't as big of a thing. Like one thing that I do notice that is a trend with Woody Allen, especially when you're hearing actors and crew members talk about the films, he's not the kind of guy that over directs.
Yeah,
he very much lets you kind of be, mm-hmm. you know, you can change the lines if you want. It's more important that the energy is there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that was applicable in the earlier stages of the editing process to his work, and just that If the feeling is there, if the emotion is there, then it's rather irrelevant if say, for example, the coloring is exactly where I want it, as long as I'm getting the response that I feel should mm-hmm. be in the film. I don't know, but it is interesting that there's just, it's like a switch flipped.
Yep, absolutely. And
yeah, so weird.
I like that switch.
All right, so my number 9 is Play It Again, Sam.
Really?
Yeah. So we're on completely...
I know.
Yeah.
Different worlds.
Yeah. Okay, so the reason I have this at number 9 is because I totally have a man crush on Humphrey Bogart, first of all. And I would love to be that guy getting advice from Humphrey Bogart. Mm-hmm. I think that's such a cool idea, and totally something original and out of the mind of Woody Allen.
Mm-hmm.
I remember to this day, like, my favorite episode of Tales from the Crypt, for example, is the episode that they have... essentially like a Bogart lookalike, mm-hmm. and that's the main character of one of the sections of the show, and there's just something magical about Bogart, and I think that it's a really interesting thing to put into the modern era, and when you hear him like tell her this or tell mm-hmm. her that, and then he's trying to change it into modern vernacular,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, I can't believe that worked, and all of these things. Yeah. It's so great. I also love that the name of the movie is essentially one of the greatest fallacies in film, in that he doesn't say "Play It Again, Sam." He never says "Play It Again, Sam" in Casablanca. But in any case, what's your number 8?
I had to renumber, so yep. Let me just go through. Okay, yes. My number 8 was Match Point.
That is also my number 8.
Ooh, weird.
Yeah, our first
match point.
Yeah.
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
So I mentioned when we were speaking before, like earlier off recording, mm-hmm. off podcast, that
off podcast, that
it kind of reminds me of Crimes and Misdemeanors and the whole idea that the mistress is being killed and, you know, that guilt and such. But there's something about this movie, just the fact that they're these aristocratic rich people that, you know, they're supposed to be so proper, but there's this very dark side to his life.
Absolutely.
Right? That's just, I really like watching that. And it's funny because when you watch that movie, you feel bad for everyone involved.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, near the end, like for a bit there, when he actually goes to kill her,
mm-hmm.
and well, I don't know why I've got like a brain block.
Scarlett Johansson.
Sorry, thank you. Oh, I'm like Johansson. Yeah. So Scarlett Johansson at the beginning.
Black Widow.
Like, yeah.
Everyone nowadays knows everyone by their comic book movie characters.
So true.
Yeah.
But yeah, so she, you feel, but you're kind of with on her side at the beginning a bit. And then you hate her too because she starts getting in his face. And then you kind of feel that frustration.
Yeah.
Right. And you want to get rid of her too. And then afterwards, you hate him at the end for actually getting rid of her. So I find the whole movie is kind of an emotional ride.
Okay, I actually, I struggle with this one, having it at 8, because I feel like something else should be there, because I'm not a fan, even though I've seen and enjoyed a lot of the films that he's in, I am not a fan at all of Jonathan Rhys Meyers.
Okay.
I don't like him. I understand his style of acting, but I don't subscribe to it. It actually really bothers me, but that just reaffirms when I was making this list, it reaffirmed for me this film is that good because it has to be on this list.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the scene in the wheat field,
yeah,
which I heard. Yeah. Same documentary,
yeah.
Scarlett Johansson has an allergy to wheat,
allergy.
So
yeah,
probably Woody having a little fun at her expense on that one. There's it's a really sexy movie.
Yeah,
it's a really sexy movie.
He can't help himself. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like he just can't, right? And then he's so can't help himself that he ends up having to kill her, like because she's, you know, she gets pregnant, she's going to tell his wife, and he wants this perfect life. But I mean, at no point is there a reason why he can't really just, you know, change his life and just go with her. But she's like she's supposed to remain the kind of unattainable thing that he wants, but he's not supposed to actually, you know, he has to be that person that he was raised to be the whole time. So.
Which is so interesting. Like you mentioned that it reminds you of Crimes and Misdemeanors. Like to me, it feels more like something like From Here to Eternity or something like that, you know, but actually the opposite, where Montgomery Clifton, that obviously wants to be with
Elizabeth Taylor.
There we go.
Yeah, wants to be.
Yeah. He wants to be with Elizabeth Taylor, and so he actually gets rid of his
wife.
Yeah, that is of lesser, you know, seen as of being on a, you know, of the lower echelon of people, if you will. So that's kind of the inverse of that, but very similar how it plays out. Kind of interesting. Well, it comes to a different conclusion, but I feel as though maybe I like Match Point because I do like From Here to Eternity so much. It's hard to tell.
Maybe.
Yeah. And so it's Elizabeth Taylor's fault that
it's Elizabeth
my
Taylor's
attraction
fault.
To her. Yeah. It's perpetuating my liking of this film. But yeah, great film. Number 8.
That was number 8. Yeah. Now we're number 7.
Mm-hmm. What's your number 7?
I'm almost curious now. Like, are we going to have any more, you know?
Well, let's see.
I'm trying to peek over. My number 7 is...
I can't read your writing, by the way, so there's no
scribbling.
Cheating for me.
Midnight in Paris.
Oh, okay.
Yes. I love that movie. I thought it was really cool how he goes back in time and it's in Paris. And there's, you know, again, there's the cold fiancé, right? Like, so there's a relationship that he's in and it's just like a cold kind of dead relationship. And there's this hopeless romantic that goes out for walks at night. And he kind of finds that world that caters to that part of him, right?
Yeah.
Again, it's like that personal outside world that exists outside of your normal life. But I wouldn't put it higher than number 7 because even though it was really good, I I just don't think it's, you know, it's not my number one or number two. It's a solid number seven, I think.
Okay, well, we disagree on that, but we'll get to that further on into my list. Yeah. It's a really unique film. I completely agree. I echo your sentiments with regards to the element of the idea of this kind of restless spirit and going out into the night to kind of seek going solace. Yeah, it sounds dirty, but whatever. There's something pretty and there's something magical about it that I love in storytelling in general. It takes you to another place. It's so interesting because this Owen Wilson's character, of course, he gets to kind of be our guide through a film where everyone else thinks that he is crazy.
Exactly.
You know.
Mm-hmm. He meets his heroes, and I think that's something that everyone wants. Like if you could
absolutely.
Go for a walk and
if I could just go
heroes.
Back
it's amazing.
I would hang out with Hemingway.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh man, that'd be amazing.
But there's a very interesting point in that movie when they're in, I think they're in the 20s,
yeah,
and he's talking to
and she feels the same way.
She's no, they're in the 40s.
Like they go back again. Mm-hmm. They use the same conduit to go back one more
exactly.
time.
And she's like, oh, you know, these are the good old days. And he's like, what are you talking about? You know,
yeah,
your days are
you're the best.
So I think every generation has that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't really appreciate what we've got until later on. Although right now, I don't know, things are a little dry. But
yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. It is a weird era, too. And I think that maybe you're right. Maybe that's why I have it a little bit higher on my list is because I very much feel what Gil's going through mm-hmm. in that film and that he, Marion Cotillard's character's name again? What the hell is it? Hey, Devin, can you help me out here? No. it doesn't matter. In any case, she embodies everything of this era, this lost era that he loves. And, you know, mm-hmm. obviously F. Scott Fitzgerald and Hemingway and all these amazing thinkers and, mm-hmm. There's something it very much it's inherent in our society that you say are the good old days.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. So,
in any case, my number, we're at seven, right?
We are at seven. Yes.
Yeah, so my number seven is Manhattan.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so my number seven is Manhattan for a couple of reasons. One, because I think that the whole film takes place through rose-colored glasses, mm-hmm. rather. I think that much in the way that, say, for example, a lot of other filmmakers that have come out of New York or any given city, they have a very specific look at their hometown, and it does come out differently. I needed to have this on my top 10. Mm-hmm. Again, Gordon Willis, cinematographer, amazing work. I love that it's in black and white. I can't put it higher, though, because I just feel that emotionally, the story can't get me to where I want to go in the same way as other films that have touched on the subject matter of the film. Like, aesthetically, mm-hmm. It's breathtaking. Like, the scene where you can just see the lights on the train. Mm-hmm. Rolling by on the track outside the ballpark. Like, that's amazing. And the Gershwin music is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Everything about the film is just aesthetically gorgeous. And I know that, like, say, for example, they brought out that bench for the last scene because there's not a bench there. Everyone knows that story is on every fucking website that talks about that movie.
The sunrise?
Yeah, yeah. And it's that's beautiful. And Keaton is amazing in it. I just... For example, like you know, when you were here for the Kubrick episode, I nominated Lolita as the mm-hmm. first film that people should see out of Kubrick's catalog, mm-hmm. and I just feel that film tackles the subject matter of love and the hardships of love that exist between or that may be taboo but just happen, you know, almost serendipitously or something like that. I think it just does a better job. I just think that there's better movies that cover a lot of the subject matter in that film. But It's a great film.
So you mean in parallel to the relationship that he has with like the 16, 17 year old girl?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because again, like the ending again just seemed like a cop out to me.
A little bit.
Where she wanted him and then he comes to her and, you know, you're telling, why couldn't you tell me this a few days earlier and this whole nonsense and just, you know, I'll be back. And, okay. So you're ending everything on kind of a happy note. And I just, as much as I enjoy it, there's just something there that seems like they're padding. He's patting the audience on the head and you know, saying it's going to be okay. And that's not very Woody Allen to me, but.
I see what you're saying, but I almost see it as like, he just falls back in, you know, he just settles back into his usual self.
Yeah.
He has this, you know, great experience with Diane Keaton. He has the relationship with her. He, you know, goes out, does these new things, breaks up with the younger girl. And then at the end, when he's lost all that other stuff that, you know, all these new experiences that he's had, he's sitting there recording what he is grateful for or happy about. And he remembers, you know, the smile on her face and goes and sees her. So I think it's more of just, instead of a, like a cop out, I think it has to do more with him just, he doesn't change, you know, he's still himself. He's always going to be himself. So it's almost like he's kind of hopeless. It has that feel to it. Like he's hopeless, you know? He's just going to go back to that 17-year-old girl because that's who he is, right?
I understand that. And I understand, like, that their relationship in its, at its jump-off point is very much one of convenience for both of them. That they are taking something from the other. And then they realize that the sharing with that other person is the more important element of their relationship and what they're getting out of it. I understand all of this. I think it's a very powerful and moving film, not just visually, but also story-wise. I just think that, again, I can't put it higher, not because I don't love the film, but just because I feel as though there's other films that did a lot of the elements I like, the humor, some of the side stories, so forth, did it better. But some of the most beautiful black and white cinematography you'll ever see.
Absolutely.
But in any case,
okay.
Do you want to, let's go, let's do one more each, take a little break, and then we'll finish off the list. What do you have at number six?
Okay, so at number six, I have Annie Hall. And that is because it's an amazing movie, but it's, I appreciate it as a really great Woody Allen movie. I can watch it. You know, it's a great ride, I guess you could say, I mean, emotionally, but there's, I don't know. It's just, it's kind of sad. And I find that movie to leave me a little heartbroken.
Yeah.
So that's why I've got to put it in my top 10, but it's not one that I would watch repeatedly like some of my other ones, for example. It's not, say, like a Midnight in Paris where you could pop it in every once in a while and watch it, you know, while you're doing other things if you wanted to have something in the background. Like, I wouldn't watch Annie Hall unless I was in a very particular mood. So, but it's a great movie.
Again, I have this a little bit higher, but I actually echo your sentiments, even though I have it a bit higher, and we're going to get to that in a minute, or we won't. We'll get to maybe we'll get to it in a minute. But I think for me, I feel like it should be higher than six. I feel like it should, because it, not even just from the standpoint of its significance in society, but just that it is a film that, say, for example. Something like When Harry Met Sally, where it kind of touches on similar, again, this getting back together, you know, relationship falling apart and so on over the years, and this kind of thing. That film is clearly just, it's a great film, it's a fun film, but it's just a film. It's just a movie. And I think there's something that is transcendental about Annie Hall. Like, that first moment that you see Diane Keaton on screen, it's just, and again, this is both the first Woody Allen film that I ever saw, and also the first Diane Keaton film. I'm pretty certain. I may be wrong about that. Probably saw her, but didn't put it in context. Especially a young Diane Keaton, and there's something just really, really, really special about her. I also like the idea of how they let the chronology play out. I just think it's a cool film, you know.
Absolutely.
But we'll, it's okay. I forgive
you.
A
little bit, but you're in that relationship with them, you know?
No, I totally understand where you're coming from. I just can't. I got to put it higher. Okay. I got to put it higher than that.
Okay.
But, absolutely. Okay, so at my number six is Hannah and Her Sisters.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 1986. Okay. Great cast, great film, and some of the most interesting, almost appearing haphazard camera work, but secretly just genius. There's shots where literally you're looking at a fucking door frame.
Yep.
And people are like the doctor walking back and forth and talking. And later on, there's a Steadicam shot where they're following.
Mia's in there.
That's Mia. Yeah. That, and that's who it is. It's Mia Farrow. And then she turns and walks away and you're just looking at her fucking back. You're looking at every character's back for like 10 seconds, which is really great.
It's like you're there.
Yeah. We talked off air a little bit about Diane Wiest, her character in the film, and just, I don't know. She's my favorite. She's my favorite. Michael Caine, just that opening monologue right off the top, really great. And then the way he just kind of pursues things in almost a shady way, but he can't help himself, much like what we talked about with, say, for example, Match Point or something like that. This seems to be a reoccurring theme in Woody Allen's films, where he just simply can't help himself. And say, for example, encounters her at a bookstore and all of these things. So it's an awesome film. Got to put it. Year I was born, and I have to put it at number six, not because of the year I was born, but just because it still looks brand new today, other than the smoking and the crazy in restaurants and the crazy hairstyles.
That's still a shock.
Yeah, no, so weird.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned the camera shots. And that's one thing that, one of the many, many things that I love about his movies, especially those older movies. And he did carry that into some of the newer movies. You do see it where, like, that empty room. Mm-hmm. I call it, like, the empty room shot, where you'll see an empty room and you hear voices off camera. Mm-hmm. And then people will walk into the room and then walk out of the room. And it's like you're just sitting in this chair in this room and this whole scenario is happening, right? So it's happening like, the camera doesn't follow everyone. And I find that to be really interesting. You're imagination kind of puts it together as if you're not supposed to be listening in. You're just kind of, you know, eavesdropping on the storyline.
What's the one with Josh Brolin and Naomi Watts, and they're a married couple, and he's struggling to finish up his book. Is that You'll Meet a Tall Dark Stranger?
Isn't he always struggling to finish up a book in every movie? He's always a writer.
Or is that... In either case, there's a lot of those shots in that film. You're absolutely right. But there's just something special about it. We'll get into it more, but there's something special about Mia Farrow. In a film directed by Woody Allen, whatever you want to say about their personal relationship afterwards, withstanding, but the other thing is the female character is something that for most male directors seems to almost be something that stylistically changes them. And no matter what I love so much about this film is that no matter who is the focal point of a scene, whether it's, you know, Woody Allen freaking out because he thinks he has cancer, you know, he's just this insane hypochondriac, or whether it's, you know, again, Diane Wiest with her catering business and fucking trying to get Sam Watterson's attention from away from Carrie Fisher, these kinds of things. It's always very much, you know, you're watching a Woody Allen film. Mm-hmm. And I respect that because I feel as though, especially in that era, there still was in the 80s this almost underlying unspoken sexism. And with a lot of male directors. And I feel as though a lot of the female characters in his films, I find myself way more attached to than the male characters.
Absolutely. And that might be why so many people scoff at his movies. Mm. I don't know if you've ever noticed, but a lot, well, it's very out there that a lot of people are like, oh, Woody Allen, I hate him. It's like, why? I don't know. It's that whole, you know, just society sees him as he normalizes things that are normal, mm-hmm. but, you know, and he shows them to you in movies, in his films, and just it makes people uncomfortable because of just their own personal beliefs that these things are wrong. Like, you know, you don't do this or you don't do that. And it's like, well, no, he's making it very clear. And he's kind of showing you from the eyes of the person that's living these things. And I think it makes people uncomfortable because they can relate. So they just don't, they don't like it. Right.
That makes sense. And I, as far as film nerds scoffing at him, I think some of that is also the fact that he plays out a lot of his scenes in master shots, much in the way that they scoff like modern day at, say, someone like Kevin Smith, for example, who we just did an episode on. And I think I might have went off in a little tangent or two defending him, and I would do the same in terms of filmmaking skill for Woody Allen, because they're, again, like... while there's something to, say, for example, being able to drive emotion with camera work or with music or any of these things, isn't it all the more powerful if you can literally play out a scene from a master shot and, mm-hmm. and get the same emotional response from it?
Exactly.
Because there's something there in the acting. It's very much something pure, like his essence as a writer, taking from the stage, you know, taking mm-hmm. from a live performance element. Mm-hmm. And there's that's something kind of pure and beautiful about a lot of his work. Mm-hmm. And it bothers me that a lot of, at least film snobs, not that they're the only people scoffing at his work, but they do very much see him sometimes as lazy or pretentious on the flip side. And I think that they're just upset that maybe perhaps it's just coming to him much easier mm-hmm. than everyone else.
I think it's just the way he pulls his cast together. He just casts perfect people in the perfect roles and play the roles that he wants. So the acting's impeccable. Mm.
There are a few examples, though, where he's just completely viciously given someone the axe.
Yeah.
Most notably, probably, although correct me if I'm wrong, Michael Keaton was originally cast in the Jeff Daniels role in Purple Rose of Cairo, right? Which is kind of one of my honorable mentions. It didn't make my list, but I do really love that film. It's, in all seriousness, probably the film that I kind of fell in love with Mia Farrow as an actress. Mm-hmm. Not my favorite of hers, mm-hmm. but there's something you can't help but just, again, relate to her. No one else, I don't care about anyone else in that film. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Jeff Daniels, from what I've seen, is so much better than Keaton and has the right energy. Now, I'm a huge Michael Keaton fan, right? Batman, 89. but same with, a lot of his stuff. Like, he's just, and obviously he's making a resurgence now. And Jeff Daniels, also another guy, who's just had a string of great movies as of late. You know, The Martian and not Dumb and Dumber too, but in any case, yeah.
Dumb and Dumberer.
But yeah, it's I understand the recasting in that situation, but he does have a very, he's unapologetic with you know, taking the axe to people if he needs to get the performance. He doesn't want to tell someone, and I completely understand that too.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to tell someone that they're shitty at doing their job. Just do a better job. Oh, you can't? All right, here's someone new.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not that I don't like you as a person. We can go out for beers after this or whatever, but if you're not good, you're not good. Bye.
I think too, with when it comes to acting, if you coach someone to be something that they're not, if it doesn't come naturally, it just doesn't come through as honest.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually will affect the finished product.
Absolutely. Do you want to take a little break?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to take a little break. We'll come back and knock down our top five respectively. I'm sure there's probably going to be nothing else in common the rest of the way. So it should be interesting.
Well, you've already hit some of mine.
So. Yeah, and you've hit some of mine. So
should be interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
However you're taking part in this episode, please don't forget to leave comments, share, reach out to us, so we can keep the conversation going. Okay, so we're back, and we finished our wine bottle. We're drinking wine and talking about Woody Allen. So we have to get through the rest of our list here. All right, so number five, Paula, what's your number five film?
Okay, So my number five is, and yes, there is a theme with the whole newer Woody Allen, but it's Magic in the Moonlight.
I know.
Yeah, I know.
You're going to have to explain this one to me.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so I think this movie is amazing.
I just want to point out to you before you go into this, look at the Rotten Tomatoes score on this.
Okay, so 52%, that's fine. But I really like that movie.
Okay.
And it's not just because I love the cast. I mean, I love the cast. Sorry, I was a little biased. But I just love the whole concept of he goes in, Colin Firth's character goes in to uncover, you know, to kind of show that people will be willing to believe anything just because they want to have a little faith in something, right?
Absolutely.
So he goes in to unmask this medium slash, like, what is she? She's like a psychic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of tears her apart. And it was so fun because, as you know, with Woody Allen being an atheist and me being kind of a raging atheist and not very quiet about it and very outspoken about it, it was a really fun movie because it was a very fun kind of classy way to show something that I think all the time, and that is that he says in the movie, like, he feels sorry for people who are delusional enough to want to believe those things, right? And it's bad, but I can relate with that. And
yeah,
like, oh, it's such a nice way to say it, because, you know, I feel like such a jerk, but I understand the sentiment.
Yeah, it's a funny movie. At times, I'll give you that.
You don't like it. It
certainly wouldn't be in my top ten. The wine is starting to come down a little bit. There's films that I don't even have on this list that I would rate higher than that. Like Radio Days is higher than that film for me.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Crimes and Misdemeanors, which is not on my list, so I'm kind of giving something away. I would put that higher.
Really?
Yeah, Purple Rose of Cairo, I'd put higher. Stardust Memories, I'd definitely put higher.
Really?
Yeah, like there's a lot that... it's a brave choice, I'll give you that.
I actually really liked it.
We're going to give out your Twitter at the end of the show, and we'll let the internet decide.
I didn't look at the Rotten Tomatoes, I just watched it.
Either, but I'm just saying... Seems as though people seem to agree with me here. It's right in the middle.
That's okay. It doesn't mean they're right.
Yeah. Okay. I concur. I concur. We very rarely agree on the show with critics and whatnot. So, all right. My number five is Sleeper.
Okay.
Yeah. This one, again, continuing the theme of you're taking all the new ones, I'm taking all the old ones. I love this film. Just the idea of this health store owner that's just completely adamant about all of he's almost the same kind of neuroses that you see in a lot of Woody Allen characters, especially with the hypochondria and the fear of death and these sorts of things. But this film is kind of manifested in his, you know, obsession with health foods and things like that. And so he's frozen. He wakes up in the future and where he finds out that everything that he believed, of course, is wrong, and like they're eating sugar and doing all these chocolate and eating all these terrible things. It's great. Some of the best physical comedy, I think, that it exists in his entire catalog. And so, for example, you just made a bold statement of putting Magic in the Moonlight at number five? That's a bold statement to say that some of the best physical comedy in his entire repertoire is in this film. But I believe it to be so.
You're just gonna keep digging at that.
Oh, totally. That's gonna come back to haunt you a week from now. I'm gonna send you a message like, Magic in the Moonlight, really? This is another one of my favorite of Diane Keaton's. I love the behind the scenes footage of her just they're trying to replicate his the early stages of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And her delivering these lines, and they're all just cracking up. They can't keep it together.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole scene, when you see it in the film, that plays very deadpan, and you're laughing at Woody, and then to see behind the scenes that everyone's actually reacting to Diane Keaton is so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Just a really interesting film. Cool music. I really like the music in this film. And it's just, it feels good. I guess I never saw this in the theaters. I'm too young, but you finish that film and you feel almost refreshed. And again, it's always fun for me. I like thinking about the future and stuff. Like, you know, Devin has brought that up in past episodes, like Blade Runner and stuff like that. We've done episodes on Terminator and a lot of dystopian future kind of concepts. And it is interesting to see Woody Allen's take on that.
Mm-hmm.
I really like it. It's so much fun.
It is a great movie.
Great movie.
I can't disagree with you at all.
Okay, I'm number like four.
You disagreeing with mine. I'm almost afraid to continue.
No, please, please.
Okay,
you're in a safe place.
Sure, for now. But okay, so my number four is To Rome with Love. Oh, God. I can see the look on your face. I know. Okay, listen, I really love that movie. The whole, and it's funny because it's different storylines, right? Mm-hmm. And they're all equally. How many,
there's like three or four vignettes in this film.
Because
there's young, like four, young Alec Baldwin.
Alec Baldwin's, and then there's the couple and the dad that's the opera singer.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's in it. Yeah, so it's about three or four.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But my favorite, I mean, it really makes... Oh, the guy who is famous for no reason, who just leaves his house and he's famous and everyone just wants his autograph. And what do you mean for breakfast, you know? That's amazing. But my favorite storyline from that whole film is the singer, the opera singer, the guy who can only sing in the shower.
Yes. Right?
And Woody Allen is just so obsessed with him. And he just, you know, I know a guy in the recording industry and, you know, you've got to sing for him. And the son is like, nope, leave him alone, leave him alone. He said he's not interested. And he takes him, you know, he twists his arm, basically takes him to audition for this guy. And he's terrible. Turns out he can only sing in the shower.
Yeah. And then they have to bring the shower out on stage.
So,
yeah,
like, so I mean, I don't know. You know how much I love opera, right? So to watch this happen, I mean, there's this like,
Yeah, you've dragged me to the opera a few times.
So there's this opera playing out, and then, you know, all the drama is playing out. Everyone's dancing around, this chorus is singing, and then they, you know, they wheel out this shower, and this guy's washing himself, and he's got this magnificent voice, and he's just amazing. Then afterwards, they're reading the reviews, and they call Woody Allen's character an imbecile. You know, so this imbecile brought this guy out. You know, whoever put this together is an imbecile. And he's like, oh, what does that mean, imbecile? He's like, did you hear what does that mean? And they're like, oh, it just means that you're ahead of your time, right? but it's hilarious, and it's so true. It kind of plays on the whole. Everyone thinks they're a good singer in the shower, and you know, it's hilarious. I love it.
Yeah, I forgot all about the whole just famous for no reason with Roberto Benigni,
Mr.
Right?
What's his name? Pisanillo or Pisalo. I can't remember what his name is in the movie, but
sorry.
Go ahead. The couple that goes away to meet his family. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoy Ellen Page in this film.
Yeah, she's pretty good.
She's fantastic. Good.
But she plays the classic Woody Allen temptress, you know? Oh, the friend's coming to stay, and it's like, oh, that's trouble, right? Yeah, right away, Alec Baldwin's kind of like, nope. Yeah. She plays that. The story she tells are all kind of like, you know, tantalizing, kind of gets the imagination going.
Gets Jesse Eisenberg, like, all, like, young Alec Baldwin, all
exactly.
hot and bothered. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, her,
maybe that's why I like her so much.
Maybe, yeah. And she starts talking about how, you know, she had the one boyfriend and she breaks up with him, and how she's her like first female on female experience, and she gets all detailed, and he's just sitting there and he's like borderline sweating. It's hilarious. It's a great movie. See, it's a good number four.
Okay. Is it your four? Number four, that's where we are.
Yeah,
okay, so
number
my number four, much higher than your list, is Annie Hall.
Okay.
Okay. This is the first one I saw of his. And from the second, I think it's probably the lobster scene. Like from that point, you're on board. Mm-hmm. Because the other magical thing about the film is obviously that you see it comes through the camaraderie and the love between Diane Keaton and Woody Allen. And you see that play out on screen. And it's, I know this was a touchstone for that era, and I didn't get to experience that, but there is something magical about the film, and something that that's intangible and almost inexplicable. There's some reason that I like to go back to this so regularly, and It's probably one of the ones, in all seriousness, other than the ones that are above this on my list, that I watch the most.
Really?
And yeah, it's a fun film. It actually is really aesthetically pleasing. And I love, for me, it's one of the first films before any of the Tarantino, before any of the, you know, PTA or even Kevin Smith stuff that I've come to love, where I found dialogue like what I wanted, or like what I heard among my friends. These conversations that you're in a bookstore and you're talking about, you know, your fear of dying and things like this. It just it resonates, and it's ageless, and it's near perfect. It's a near perfect film, and probably the most responsible look at love that I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's my number four.
That's probably why I don't like it as much as the other ones. It's almost too real, right? It's
bums you out.
Kinda, yeah, because like you relate to it so much, and you're just like, oh my gosh, these are the conversations in life, and I can see myself being there. I'm these people, and then you know you watch it play out, just like life plays out. It's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, you're right. There's nothing fantastical about this film. Mm-hmm. I'll give you that. But then again,
a little empty.
Yeah, some of the times when he goes a little too fantastical, mm-hmm. it leaves you either wanting more, or it leaves you kind of between the two worlds, because mm-hmm. he always does try and balance them. I think probably in that regard, the best job he ever did of that is almost Midnight in Paris, because mm-hmm. he is able to reconcile the fantastical side of the film mm-hmm. with the realistic side of the film in such a an even way that you as a viewer don't feel that there's any change.
Yeah,
you feel
absolutely.
That these scenes are more surreal, but mm-hmm. the interactions between the characters are all on the same level, and the emotional response is very mm-hmm. much still always a heightened one.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I can understand, but there's something both aesthetically super pleasing about the film, probably somewhat accidentally, and also the dialogue, the character development, everything's just on point for me.
Funny that you mentioned the two movies. I was just thinking, if you look at a film like Midnight in Paris, he's going back in time, he's talking to his heroes, and all of these things are happening, but in a way, that's kind of what happens to us when we're watching films, when we're reading books, when we're listening to music. You know, we have these like out of current time and space experiences where we are taken to a different place and then we come back. So it's almost like his more recent movies are sort of showing you, you know, that kind of fantasy side. So it's not necessarily that we actually go back in time, but you know, certain things just bring us back to a certain place in time, or you know what I mean? Like it has that feeling to it.
But you don't feel that his older catalog did that? You
it
don't
did,
feel
it,
say, for example, I just brought up my number five was Sleeper, right?
Absolutely. And I think it does, but I just think now it's just more, what's the word I'm looking for?
Awesome.
Yeah. It's almost just like, it's like, it's more of a story storyline now than it was before, where it was more blatant. Now it's just kind of, you know, take this movie with you and sort of apply it to your life in a way where you realize that you do this, but maybe not to the same extent. It's just like when you do this, you know, when you watch a film, you're kind of gone. And when you listen to music, you're kind of gone. And, you know, it's the same kind of feeling.
I know. I know what you mean. Yeah. I think it did exist earlier. Like, for example, I already said one of my favorites on my top 10, Play It Again, Sam.
Mm-hmm.
Stardust Memories kind of does the same thing, where you're literally, everything's from the perspective of in a different way, I suppose, because Play It Again, Sam, you're drawing from, he is experiencing something that you also wish you could almost experience.
Yeah.
But say, for example, with Stardust Memories, you are put into looking through the looking glass of a individual who is experiencing celebrity and is overwhelmed. And for example, you know, I really like your older films and these sorts of things, especially the funny
especially
ones.
Especially the funny ones.
Yeah. And these sorts of things. So I totally concur with what you're saying. I just don't think that that's only prevalent in his. It goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning, where it almost is like a wink to the audience, or he is in the audience with you and just being like, hey, look at this. Hey, that was pretty. I like it. Number four. Or no, we just did that. Number three. Four.
Yep.
Number one.
Number three?
Yep.
Okay. So my number three.
Okay.
Is Hollywood ending. I know. You can sip your wine. It's okay. You
almost
may need
choked
it.
There.
Okay, so Hollywood ending. The whole concept of a director having to direct a film blind. He goes blind because he's working for his ex-wife's new husband. Mm-hmm. I find that amazing. I mean, that movie is just genius to me. She hires him because she thinks he's the right guy for the film. And he's conflicted because he wants to be close to her, mm-hmm. but he's working for her husband. So it's like his body or his subconscious is fighting him. So he can't see. He has to do it blind. The cameraman has to help him. The cameraman has an assistant that has to translate everything for him. It's hilarious. I think it's amazing.
Okay.
You don't think so? It's such a good movie.
Again, like, and here's the thing, like, I'm not passing judgment because, for example, like I already said, I don't have Stardust Memories on my list. I don't have Bananas on my list. I don't have, like, there's a handful of films that I don't have on my list that should probably be up there to a lot of Woody Allen fans and cinephiles all the same. But, wow, that's really high for that film.
Really?
It's amazing that that connects with you so much. That's fantastic.
I just think it's hilarious. And he's a total hypochondriac, you know, typical Woody Allen. Yeah. He's, you know, he's in there, he's taking a couple Xanax and he's like, you know, upper downer, upper downer, upper downer. And just the whole thing, he's just such a neurotic. And she left him because he was a neurotic. And just the whole relationship between them, right?
I do love, it's incredibly fun. It's a strong female character or another trait of his. Yeah, there's a lot of staples of his body of work in the film. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. You're bringing me around.
Hey, they're my top 10.
Yeah,
right?
No, that's all right. Yeah, we don't have to agree.
So what's your number three?
My number three is Midnight in Paris.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I have this way higher than you.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, which is surprising because you're the new school fan,
I
right?
I know.
Yeah. There's a handful of things that I absolutely adore about this film. I think... off the top, the obvious one is that I very much have some of the same literary heroes as Owen Wilson's character, as Gil.
I was about to say, that doesn't surprise me because of your, you know, reading background. You're very much, I think you see the world in comparison to books.
Yeah.
You compare real life to books. So that movie totally makes sense to me being high on your
Again,
list.
Again, I can't tell if you're making fun of me.
I'm not.
Also, I totally have a huge crush and have for a very long time on Marianne Cotillard. Yeah, she's just...
So it's just up there.
Yeah, it's just... Oh, beautiful. And, you know, you got to respect some Canadiana here. And Rachel McAdams playing like some... Just a lovely, neurotic character. And honestly, almost kind of playing the Woody Allen role in a Woody Allen film.
Yeah, that's true.
And it is a unique... unique performance. I just think that the film, like we already talked about, and I can't spend too long on it, but say for example, like when Owen first goes back and he meets like Ernest Hemingway, who's played amazingly, by the way, by Corey Stoll, who most people will either know from his go around in the Ant-Man film or his role in the first season of House of Cards. Fantastic. And literally his vocal delivery is exactly how I read Hemingway novels.
Really?
So it's like I was getting goosebumps when I saw it. I was like, this is fucking amazing. And also maybe it means a lot more to me because I did get to see this one in the theaters. And it is exceptional. Tom Hiddleston is amazing as F. Scott Fitzgerald. Amazing cast from top to bottom. The story is beautiful. I love the balance. Like I already said, I'm just regurgitating the same stuff, but of the fantastical and reality kind of blending. And you have to find that balancing point. And I love that. And then the fact that he goes back to his own time and kind of finds solace in living his own life because of the fact that he sees that everyone feels the same way that he does.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something in that. You know, I wonder if, say, for example, as a musician, if I was to go back and talk to a guy from, say, for example, like Deep Purple or something like that, if he'd be like, oh, man, like the 20s or the 40s, like that was where it was at.
I don't know. I might say the 20s or the 40s, that's where it was at.
Yeah. You just like those dresses.
The hair.
Yeah. See, for me, like, just put on a suit.
The jazz.
I already do that now.
There you go.
Yeah, the music is pretty solid. I'll give you that.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty solid music.
You can still pull that off nowadays, but it's just not the same.
I mean, you still get some dirty looks and stuff.
Yeah, and you've still got, like, twerking and all this crap.
All right. Numero dos.
Okay. It's funny, actually, that you mentioned that it was the first that... What was the first movie you saw? The Annie Hall?
Yeah.
The one you saw? Yeah. We should have probably included two subcategories, and that's the first movie you saw of Woody Allen's, and then second, who played the Woody Allen character the best in a Woody Allen comedy or in a Woody Allen film, okay. Right? That's kind of interesting. I mean, it would take a while to think about it, but
yeah.
They all have it. We'll do it
between segments.
All of his movies have the Woody Allen character, so it's just who did it. Anyhow, so number two, and I'm not even going to look at you because you're going to roll your eyes. My number two is Deconstructing Harry.
Okay. No, not that bad for me.
Okay.
I respect that.
Perfect.
Not on my list, but I respect it.
And that's just one of the funniest movies I have ever watched, just from beginning to end. Every beat of that movie is hilarious. It's got a tragic feel to it. You know, there's the typical Woody Allen storylines where they can't help themselves and they just do things that society would scoff on. And I think it's an amazing movie. But the key moment for me in that movie that always stands out is Robin Williams's part where he's soft.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean, to this day, when anything's happening and someone says, like, they feel weird, I say, oh, maybe you're a little soft, right? So it's I just think it's hilarious how for a filmmaker to make fun of this, the scenario is that someone is soft and he expects the whole world to adapt to him by wearing glasses, right? As opposed to figuring out what's wrong with him.
Mm-hmm.
Just the whole thing is the whole psychoanalysis. I mean, it's classic Woody Allen. It's hilarious.
Yeah, it is. And out of his films in the 90s, this one does rank pretty high for me, especially that late in the 90s. Like, what is this, 97?
Yeah, it's a bit 97. Later.
So, yeah, he had kind of fallen off in terms of my favorite films. I don't know. I think definitely that's probably one of my favorites out of the 90s of his, you know. So I respect that.
That one's okay?
Yeah.
All right.
You don't need my approval. You don't need my approval at all. You
know, I don't know. You almost choked on your wine, so I wasn't sure.
Well, caring about my well-being, I appreciate, but you don't need my approval. Okay. So,
my number two.
Is Take the Money and Run.
Okay, yeah.
And this was a very, very hard number two for me. I was bouncing this back and forth between this one and number one. This is the first one that he got pretty much full control over, if I'm not mistaken. Am I right on that?
Yep.
I know he was super upset after What's New Pussycat, the kind of whole mess
goofy.
That ended up being. Yeah. That is the next one.
It's funny because it was so well loved. I mean,
this movie was received incredibly when it came out. And okay, so where do I even start with this? The scene that like made it for me the first time I watched it, and I was, I guess maybe, because I guess I saw Annie Hall when I was 15, something like that. And I think I saw this one the same year, 15, 16, somewhere around there. And I didn't exactly get what I was watching. Again, mockumentary format. And the first one that I can recall other than this is Spinal Tap that I really enjoyed. But the moment when he's in the fucking marching band.
Yeah.
And he's got the cello and he's carrying the chair behind him. And he keeps sitting it down and playing. Oh, man. I had the exact same. Like, I can't keep it together.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so amazing. And what I love about this film is that it's a little bit of everything, right? Like, it's, you, you get a little bit of like an action thriller. You get a little bit of like almost like an epic drama type thing. You get the comedy. You get the documentary format. It's this blending of all these genres, and just to me, the film very much represents something that you can totally think is just going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you look at, if someone explained this film to you, you'd be like, "Wow, that sounds like a fucking mess," but it's just perfect.
Yeah.
And I love it. I love this, the whole scene when he goes into the bank the first time, and he's got the note. And
what does this say?
Yeah, and they're having trouble reading the note. And
you're gonna need a manager to sign this.
Yeah, and then he goes over to him. Oh, it's so good, just perfect. And when he's singing along with the guy in the prison, and then they give him a dirty look, and he stops singing. And his hammer comes off. I know that's really kind of slapstick, but when he pulls up the hammer and then he pulls it down and there's no end on it, and then there's just this guy like that's, you know, been impaled, or, you know, it's hit him in the head and he's just bleeding out. And you're laughing hysterically, just like, wow, I'm a terrible human being.
Yeah. But that's so okay.
I love this film. I love it. It goes back and forth between being my number one and number two. Mm, so you just caught me on a day where I guess it's number two.
Number two?
Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Hang on. So let's take a little break.
Okay. All
right. You're getting too excited here.
Well, we're going for number one.
We're going for number one, right? So when we come back, what we're going to do, because our number one also just happens to be, for both of us, the one that we've selected for the final part of this.
Yes.
This game we're playing.
Yes.
Okay, so when we come back, we're going to elect both our number one film and our countdown of top 10 Woody Allen films. And we are also going to argue, we're going to have a little debate, a friendly debate, about why our film should be the film saved if all other Woody Allen films were to be destroyed.
Okay, cool.
Okay?
Cool.
Sweet. I just want to remind everyone to visit our website, moviesruinmylife.com. Send us your ideas. What do you want to hear on the show? What do you want to see on our site? Get in touch with us. Tell us what you think. Tell us off. Whatever. moviesruinmylife.com. That's where you're going to find us. All right, so we're back, and it's the moment of truth. And I lost the hypothetical coin toss between the segments, so I'm going first. So my number one film, and the film that I would save in the event that all other Woody Allen films were going to be destroyed, would be Broadway Danny Rose.
That's a good choice.
Yeah, it's the best choice, in fact.
All right.
Well, you've had a little more wine than me, so I totally understand your you know, misreading of the situation.
Sure.
Yeah, okay. But I'm right, so that's okay. Let me take a sip here before we continue.
As you're sipping, I'll say that I was right. Yeah. You'll see why.
Okay. Now, little secret between me and the entire internet. This was actually Danny's pick until this morning when he didn't show up. We hope he's okay, and we hope he's well, and I will reach out to him, and if he's well, which I hope he is, then I'll also berate him verbally, of course. Okay, so first of all, this film is my favorite Mia Farrow performance. I love it. She's perfect. There's no one else that could play the role as good as she does, and it's so interesting because no one would think of her for a role like this.
Mm-hmm.
This is a film much like we talked about in the Kubrick episode. I'm selecting another black and white. Seems to be a trend here. But where the characters and the settings are, again, so colorful that you do not realize you're watching a black and white film. Or at least you don't recall that it's a black and white film until you go back and you watch it. And you go, oh, shit, it's black and white.
Mm-hmm.
I also love that there's a little bit of Woody Allen's managers in his character. that's so great because I love art imitating life. Mm-hmm. All the greatest artists of any genre, any art form, steal, let's be honest, yeah. or borrow from their experiences. You write what you know. And it's done so beautifully. Just the scene with the balloon making team and mm-hmm. or like their husband and wife, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and he's we're gonna make you the largest the most popular balloon making act in the world and all of this shit. It's fantastic, and I love the gangster element to it. I love crime films. I love mm-hmm. that coming into it, and I love the fact that this guy's mind just goes all over the place. And it allows me to experience a film much in the same way as Take the Money and Run, where I'm watching one film, but I'm actually getting the same thing that I could get out of five or six films. And that's so important to me because, yes, it's a comedy. Yes, it's a you know, man down on his luck kind of story, a drama. It's a gangster film or a crime film. It's a little bit of a romance. I don't know, kind of, sort of, not really. But there's all these different elements to it, and it just lends so much to your level of enjoyment. You never get bored because right when you get to the end of one part of the film, it just turns on you, sharp 90-degree turn, and you go in another direction, and you're having just as much fun as you were before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I can go on and on, so I don't want to keep doing this, but great movie. It's my favorite. It's the one I would say because I could get the most hours of enjoyment out of it. And that's the way I'm looking at it. I'm looking at it as I can watch it over and over again, regardless of mood.
Okay. I could see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that. It's not my number one, but okay. I could see that.
All right. So what's your number one?
So, you actually mentioned my number one earlier. I can't remember which number. I think it was like number 8 or 9. But so, my number one is Manhattan.
Mm, yeah, and that was my number 8.
Yeah. It's...
Oh, no, sorry, my number 7.
Okay, so it's not too bad. But so, Manhattan, just the look of it, the feel of it, the music. I mean, and most of his movies, in a lot of his movies, it's the music and the way that it ties into the visuals. That really gets to me, but it's the fact that it's black and white and just the way that he sees Manhattan, the way that he sees New York, that's timeless. And it's like a snapshot in time. When he shot that movie, you're transported back to there. They're walking around. All the dialogue's amazing. And yet everything in the background's amazing. And that whole opening sequence, like even if you were just to save that, that would be enough. It's just
the Gershwin music.
Exactly.
Plan,
yeah. Man. It's amazing. And I remember when I went to Manhattan, I swear, like that just kept playing in my head. And I took so many photos. And my first instinct with most of them was to turn them into black and white, you know, put them in black and white, because I realized that that influenced me so much that I saw it as a black and white city.
Yeah.
So it just has that classic feel to it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So yeah,
please continue.
No, that's my number one.
I talk for like 5 minutes before we get into arguing.
But that's my number one. Yeah. And I mean, it's maybe it's just because I see the world in through the photography eyes, right? Everything is a snapshot to me. And I love music so much that it just brings it together. But to me, that's the number one. And I honestly don't even know how I can argue that. It's just, I think it has to do with the way that you see the world. So I think your number one would just basically be the way that you see the world. So something that represents how you experience life. And that movie to me, the way it was shot, the way it was edited, everything about it, just those big, huge shots, the widescreen, it's the way I see the world, right?
Because you have a wider perspective than most people?
Don't say that. Maybe I see them by, I'm colorblind. No, I'm kidding. But it's just that cinematography kind of photography feel, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, I don't know. I felt good watching that movie. Like I mentioned, when I was in Manhattan, I took a lot of photos in black and white, and I printed a lot of those photos, like really dark, you know, nighttime raininess. And I saw it until I actually went to Manhattan, I didn't appreciate it as much as I did after, because when I was there, it was like, oh my gosh, I get it, right? It just, it has the pulse of that city.
Absolutely. But again, I can't get over the whole rose-colored glasses thing. He's looking,
and that's fine.
Because for me as a tourist, yeah, absolutely, going to New York is very much like that. Yeah. I concur.
And I was never mugged, so.
No. And actually, in all seriousness, people always complain about the price of parking. That was some of the cheapest parking every time I've gone to New York, in all seriousness, that you can park there cheaper than you can in Toronto.
Best food I've ever had was in Manhattan. It was cheap. It was everywhere. It was readily available. You could find absolutely anything. I mean, I saw some things that I've never seen before. I got art at my finger. I had art at my fingertips. I mean, you go for a walk for one day and the art is right there. You can see it. You can touch it. You can feel it. Everything's right around you. It was one of the best places to be.
Right on.
That movie just kind of ties all of that in.
Okay. Are we arguing now? Or
did you want to argue now? Let's sure, argue let's now. Go. All right.
Okay. So one thing I do notice, and I'm sorry, but is that all you're talking about is the cityscapes and those shots with the music and so forth, because the story is good, but it's, to harp back to why I had it at number 7, it's like it's not his most approachable of stories. And I can't get over the fact that, for example, Paula, you are a photographer and you are a wonderful photographer.
Thanks.
I'm one of your biggest fans, no doubt. Particularly your pictures of bands. No, I'm kidding. Not because
in
I'm
black
in them
and
at
white.
All. No, totally. No, I'm kidding. I totally love a lot of your work, and I totally see why this appeals to you aesthetically. But I just worry that you're kind of romanticizing this film a little bit. Like, I'm an average schmuck as far as that goes. Like, my eye is not anywhere near as good as yours. And that kind of is what takes me over to, say, a film like Broadway Danny Rose, is the fact that the aesthetic of the film is, again, beautiful. Mm-hmm. But it's not the forefront factor in the film. It's not just about those things, and there is something more than just the soundtrack, just the aesthetic. Like, you have these really rich characters that carry on into your life. I don't know, like, there's validity to your argument. I agree, it's probably one of the, if not the most beautiful of his, definitely his New York period, for sure. I'm just super fucking happy your first pick isn't like Vicky Cristina Barcelona or something like that. So I feel kind of bad picking on Manhattan, in all seriousness. Although that's not a bad movie.
Did you want me to change my options?
Change,
do you want
it,
to change Magic in the Moonlight?
Yeah, there you go.
No, yeah. Definitely. That's like, what's the last, how many movies did he make? Because can we put that at the end?
Yeah, but apologies to John Turturro, because he's he's one of my favorites. So
it was just a weak movie.
But
that's the thing, though. I'm visual.
Yes.
Right. And yes, I appreciate storyline, and storyline is great. But I need something to look at and something to listen to. That's what speaks to me more than the actual storylines. So
you'd be content just simply watching a movie that's like a slideshow with fucking music playing in the background.
Well, it depends what movie.
It's like a PowerPoint presentation. Yeah.
That sounds pretty boring, actually. But yeah, basically.
Let's be thankful you're not on the Academy every year. It's like Dave's office presentation nominated for Best Picture.
Budget 2016.
Or maybe that's what we should do.
Hey, here you go.
Infiltrate the Academy from the inside.
There you go.
I don't know. I love the movie. It's really hard to pick it apart. Feel free to pick apart Broadway if you want. Like, God damn it, it's beautiful. It really is. It is.
And I can't disagree. But that's the problem, though. See, the thing is, I think that, luckily, thankfully, we are not actually burning all of his catalog and saving one, because it's such a personal choice, right?
Yeah.
So many of his movies just speak to different aspects of people and humanities. So you can love or hate a movie. Like, you can really love or absolutely hate one of his movies because you see yourself in it.
It could be two different people, well, that's completely the thing, different right? perspectives. Absolutely.
And, you know, we don't like people because we see things that we don't like about ourselves in them.
I don't like
people. Right? Yeah, no, people suck. No. But you know what I mean, though, right? Usually when you don't like someone, it's because you see something in them that reminds you of something you don't like about yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of his movies could pull that from people. So it's like, I hate this movie because that could so be me, but you don't want to admit it, right? So I think it really depends on what movie it is. And with a movie for me, like Manhattan, that just really pulls together what I like to see the world as. I don't want to see, I don't want to see the sad stuff. I don't want to see the misery. I want to see the romanticized city and everyone's happy and there's no pain. Like just
There is a lot of pain in that.
Well, yes, no, but I mean just the visual aspect of it, right? Mm-hmm. There's the city, the music, and that's what speaks to me in that movie, which is why I wouldn't put Annie Hall higher, because as beautiful as it is and as good a story as it is,
it wasn't my first choice.
It was no, I know. I'm just saying in general. I wouldn't put it higher than I had put it. I put it at, I think, number 6.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put it higher because it leaves you a little sad. And for me, I like things that leave me feeling happy.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, I like candy. What can I say?
It's interesting, though, your perspective on the film. If you take a look at, say, for example, like, I dislike this film, and then you look at the male characters in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all fucking shitty.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
All terrible people.
It speaks to real life.
Yeah, thank you. I concur. I don't like men.
It's true, though, right? I mean, it really is like that. And it's a very realistic movie, but it has the kind of like the buffer of the beautiful scenery and the music to go along with it.
Mm-hmm. And then you look at the women.
Yeah.
And they're all fantastic. Yeah.
They always are.
The characters.
They're all a little crazy.
Yeah.
They're all a little flaky. And absolutely.
Yeah. So, I like we talked about before, I end up finding myself relating to the women in his films so much more. And this is no exception to that rule. But yeah. Broadway Danny Rose is still, you're not going to sway me.
I can't.
It's perfect.
It's a very good movie. And honestly, I can't. It's a beautiful movie. It's just really well put together. And like you mentioned, there's a lot of different aspects to it. But I personally believe that it's whatever speaks to you makes something your number one. And yeah, I can't debate it.
No, I understand. I just want to point out how good our picks were in all seriousness, or how much we're for once in line with someone. Rotten Tomatoes has, where are we here? Manhattan at 98%.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What about Deconstructing Harry? Isn't it like 35?
Yeah, 12%.
12%?
No, it's pretty good, actually. Broadway Danny Rose, 100%.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I could see that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So we're
But what about To Rome With Love, though?
Strong pick. To Rome With Love, where are we here? Where the hell is it? It should be here, right?
There it is. Oh, a 44%.
I like it.
Yeah. That sounds good. You know, honestly, I think it's whatever speaks to you, and that movie was hilarious.
Yeah.
That was funny.
Now, before we wrap it up, how do you feel about Woody's Amazon live stream deal and him kind of being this is both the first film that's going to come out through Amazon, and also he's going to do a TV series with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because obviously he's still premiered his movie at Cannes or
Cannes,
as he always does. But Amazon has the distribution rights, and of course they're allowing exhibitors to have it in theaters. What is it, 30 days before they're going to go direct to
I don't know, but I want to see it. I want to watch it. I think it's really cool that he's doing something new, like different. I mean, obviously he's always doing something,
totally.
I mean, this is totally different. He's working with Amazon now. Wasn't Miley Cyrus involved with that? I mean, bring it back to the twerk. I don't know. I heard that she was involved. But yeah, it's, you know, he's with the times. But I mean, how old is he now?
I think he's 86.
Wow, it's amazing.
We're in his 70s.
No, he's older than that.
Yeah.
He looked pretty old the last time I saw him. we were hanging out, you know. Yeah. On TV, but yeah. Mm. I think it's really great. I think it's really cool. I mean, television, movies, film, everything is changing. We don't watch things the way we used to, so like, why not adapt, right?
Yeah, and that's something you hit it on the head there for me, because say for example,
you don't
look
have to
at,
kick me just because we don't agree on number one.
Say for example, you take what a lot of critics say about Beast of No Nation. It came out on Netflix, and they say that because exhibitors were kind of snuffed by the fact that it came right to Netflix first, that's why, say, for example, Idris Elba didn't get an Oscar nom or these sorts of things. I can't help but think that Woody doesn't care.
Oh, he doesn't care. I think he's been to, like, what, one Oscar show? I mean, I don't think he's... Has he even been to the Oscars?
Yeah, the year doesn't that care he about the awards. For... He just wants to work.
Well, and it's funny because we watched the same... I know we both watched the same documentary where he talks about he just didn't think that having someone think his movie was their favorite meant anything as far as winning. Mm-hmm. It's not like track and field. Like, you're the fastest you won. It's like someone's opinion, you know, it's a complete different thing. It's not like you've earned it, right? And I don't think he's ever done it for that. He does it for himself. Mm-hmm. He wants to put his ideas on paper. He wants to see them on film. He doesn't care what they make, what they gross, what they do. As long as it makes a dollar, he thinks it's successful. So
yeah, as long as he gets to do it again.
Yeah, exactly, right? Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I think, and that there in and of itself is exactly what I think about this Amazon deal, is that he always has been a pioneer in terms of not so much the aesthetic, not so much the art of film, but the art of conveying the human condition, or conveying the overarching kind of heartbeat of society. Mm-hmm. And as people migrate to, say, for example, streaming services, say, and aren't as actively going to theaters, which is heartbreaking because I love theaters the same way as I love drive-ins. And every time I go to the drive-in, it's always packed. Mm-hmm. And you know, mind you, we're in Canada, so you only get to enjoy it 6 months out of the year. But
and a couple of those months are still pretty cold.
Still pretty cold, but yeah, it's interesting that he's totally willing to adapt, which is something that his critics would never pat him on the back for, but he totally is, and it's really interesting because when you have the buy-in from a guy like that, I think it means all that much more.
Absolutely.
It almost lends a level of validity to say, for example, in this case, Amazon Prime.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Sponsored by Amazon Prime.
This episode brought to you by Amazon Prime.
Do we get free Amazon Prime now? Let's see if we can swing it.
No, you get the promotional price of $99.99 a year.
Promotional. You get one free order.
Yeah, which is the regular price.
One free month.
I think that's the regular price in America. See, that's the thing. We don't have the streaming service up here. We only have, when you get Amazon Prime in Canada, you only get
really
free shipping.
Good shipping. Yeah, that's it. I know. I signed up. I was like, that's it. Aww.
Yeah, but soon enough, they'll get their claws in the Canadian market. They got to.
I know
do
it's
a lot
hard
because
Canada's just like way out there in the boonies. I mean, no one's heard of Canada, so for us to have the same technology, is
hey,
just
we're in
unheard
little
of.
New York with trees right now, you know, as Danny would say, tiny New York with trees.
That's true.
Toronto.
I can see that. Yeah. It looks like that.
Yeah. Well, I had a great time.
Yeah, me too. That was fun.
Yeah,
it was really fun
to
research for this episode. Absolutely. Hey, it's Woody Allen. You have to.
You have to, yeah.
We weren't going to play jazz in the background, but hey.
Okay, so...
I'm warming up for it.
Perfect. Getting ready. Remember, this is just the beginning of the conversation. We want to continue it on with you. And we really do. This is an interesting guy because no matter what we did with this episode, we wouldn't be doing him justice. And we thought it would be fun to do a little ranking. So what film would you save if you were to save one Woody Allen film as the rest are being destroyed for some reason? I don't know.
Why? What did he do?
I don't know. But
Mia Farrow got her way. No.
Oh, yeah. Probably cutting that one. In any case, yeah, let us know this week. I'm at not Brandon Fleet on Twitter. Paula, you want to offer up your Twitter?
At Paula Capellafi.
Oh, so it's like Capella and photography together?
Yes.
You might need to spell that one.
At Paulacapellafi. Capellafi. Go ahead and tweet me.
Perfect. Now, you can also follow us at Mermal Podcast, at MRML Podcast. And if you are having trouble spelling Paula Capellafi, then go to our lists and you'll find one that says Mermal Panelists. And you can subscribe to that list and follow all of our tweets and weird nonsense that we throw out into the Twitterverse. I hate that term.
Twitterverse. Into the interweb.
Yes. Ye old interweb.
Mm-hmm. Ye old. Ye old. Yeah. I'm glad I brought wine.
Yes.
Funny.
Perfect. This show's all the better now.
There you go.
All right. So if you're watching us or watching a segment on YouTube, remember to subscribe to our podcast, which you can listen to on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn. We're on pretty much every podcatcher you can think of. And if we're not there, send us a Twitter message at Mermal Podcast or an email at show@moviesroommylife.com, and we'll rectify that immediately for you. If you are listening to the podcast, thank you. And you can check us out on Twitter. We're always updating and adding new content there. So there'll be some video from this episode if there isn't already. And also upcoming episodes. We always try and release stuff a little bit early so you can get a few tidbits from the show upcoming. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing what people's choice would be. What their one film that they had to save out of the Woody Allen catalog is. So it's going to be a fun week getting yelled at by you guys. So I'm looking forward to it. Can't wait for the messages. Any final thoughts, Paula? Thanks for hanging out with us.
Drip, sorry.
You get wine all over our list here.
Yeah, there you go.
What the hell, kiddo?
It's like, what happened? All right.